You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, Candy One, Candy One. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Firefighters Local 42 and Service Employees International Union Local 1. IAFF Local 42 of Kansas City, Missouri, International Association of Firefighters, representing fire, EMS, and public safety professionals, serving you since 1918. Local 42 advocates continuously for the public good, and we depend on you to help us defend the rights of our diverse membership of men and women. And Service Employees International Union Local 1 gives workers and working families a voice in fighting for respect and dignity on the job. Our members are janitors in Kansas City and surrounding suburbs and local sports entertainment staff. We thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, who is protecting our pensions and what's fiduciary responsibility anyway? We'll find out on tonight's show when we talk to the Employee Benefits Security Administration. Then, the disabilities community will not let 40 years of progress be destroyed. That's why disability rights activists went to Washington, D.C. in May to trump the Trump before Trump trumps the disabled. In the news, Greitens calls another special legislative session. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel. Now for the news.
The news from our side, June 8th. When the Missouri legislature recessed in late May, many supporters of labor and human rights bred a sigh of relief that they wouldn't have to face any more bills this year, taking away more rights. Alas, it seemed that the governor thinks less about the Constitution and more about his political future. Yesterday, he called the state legislature back for its second extraordinary session this month. This time, it's to build his record against abortion rights and once again impose the state's will on cities and on abortion providers. So much for the small government. According to St. Louis Public Radio, Greitens has two aims. First, he wants legislatures to overturn St. Louis's revision to its anti-discrimination ordinance, which keeps employers and landlords from discrimination against women who have had abortions or plan to undergo one. Two bills were filed during the regular session, which ended May 12, targeting the ordinance. One would have shielded alternative to abortion agencies, a measure that passed the House but died in the Senate. The other would have overturned the ordinance by barring any Missouri municipality from declaring itself as a sanctuary city for women seeking abortions. It didn't even get a hearing. Second, Greitens' special session also included portions of an abortion restriction measure that passed the House but fell short in the Senate. Among the bill's provisions highlighted in Greitens' special session announcement are unannounced annual on-site inspections and investigation of any abortion clinic and expansion of the information the clinics are to send to the state health department about each abortion, including an estimate of how old the fetal organs and tissues are. State Senator Jill Shulp, a Democrat from Creve Coeur, wasn't happy with the governor's special call session. she said, calling for an expansive emergency legislative session to force bills that would endanger safety and threaten access to reproductive health care is just another example of big government intrusion into public reproduction health decisions of Missourians.
Graduate teaching and research assistants attempting to organize a labor union at the University of Pennsylvania filed a petition for recognition election with the National Labor Relations Board on May 30th, hoping that the vote could be completed and certified before President Donald Trump and state and Senate Republicans can reverse a less than a year old ruling that granted them the right to do so. Graduate student groups at private universities across the country are facing the same dilemma. The movement at Penn is being led by a coalition of graduate student workers known as Graduate Employees Together, University of Pennsylvania, or GetUp. Tonight's news was read by Michael Savoir, and I'm Molly Madden.
And I'm Judy Ansel, and with me here is Michael Savoir. And we cut the news short because we need to appeal to you to donate during this pledge drive at KKFI. Heartland Labor Forum is a treasure of KKFI. There's no other show quite like it in the area, no other show that is dedicated to bringing you news and information about working people in Kansas City, about their unions, and about how the economy affects working people. That's why you need to show your support to KKFI and help keep us on the air. The number to call is 888-931-0901. And we're delighted to say that we have a match going on right now for the next 15 minutes from Mark Andrus, who has generously pledged $125. If we can raise $125 in the next 15 minutes. So time is of the essence. please call us at 888-931-0901.
Or Judy, they could do like I did there, and that's go to our website, kkfi.org. You know, I like to remind our listeners that this is their radio station. And of course, when we recognize our personal ownership, then we feel more responsible in terms of recognizing the importance of its financial operation. So I would encourage everyone listening to call or
pledge online,
as I did.
But if you want to help us with the match, please call 888-931-0901. And we also have some premiums to offer along with your donation. On that match, pledge whatever you can. We can count two or three pledges towards that $125 match. But we do have some premiums. And we have a pretty neat new T-shirt for a $90 pledge. It has kind of looks like a rainbow on it. And it is available for the first time in both men's sizes and women's sizes. The women's size is a bit more shapely than the men's, which is the usual baggy T-shirt. So call us at 888-931-0901 and make your pledge.
Okay. Or, of course, the option of going online, kkfi.org, and making your pledge there as well.
That's true. Mm-hmm. So we also have tickets to a benefit to KKFI, and I believe that's for a $75 pledge for the Collaborations Live at the Folly Theater on June 30th. And this is one of these super creative events where they ask artists from who play different kinds of music to work together in pairs to come up with their own new blend and creativity in music. So we've got groups like Quixotic Fusion paired with Calvin Arsenia, Kelly Hunt paired with Jeff Black, Enrique Chi of Making Movies, and Art As. Okay, Art has, and there's many more. So you can get a ticket, two tickets, I think it is, to the Collaborations Live for $75, for a $75 pledge. So call us at 888-931-0901. Jen?
Looks like we've got a couple of pledges that are on the way. I'm seeing the phone's busy in there right now, so good. We should be getting some names in here to thank on the air very shortly.
All right. So let's go to the program, the most important part. Michael?
Okay. Well, tonight our show, I'm Michael Savoie, and tonight our show is the Employee Benefits Security Administration, and we have the senior benefit advisor with us, Fran Gray. Fran is runs the organization over there, and we're going to welcome her to the Heartland Labor Forum. How are you tonight, Fran?
I'm great, Michael. Thanks for letting us
so
come by.
Good to have you here. Could you provide for our listeners some overview of the duties of your agency and what you do?
Right. I work for the U.S. Department of Labor, Employee Benefits Security Administration, mm-hmm. as you made mention of, and we are the division of the Department of Labor that has oversight and responsibility for the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, ERISA, as it's probably better known. Mm-hmm. That particular regulation is provides oversight and compliance and enforcement activities related to employer-sponsored or union-sponsored benefit plans, such as pensions or health plans or other related type benefits that an employer or union would sponsor.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just recently went to your website, and I'm a retiree, of course, and I wish I had had access to that information before I went out. I would have certainly been a much better informed retired person. So I was amazed at how much service you do provide for retirees and in health and welfare benefit. So what's the mission for your organization?
Well, the mission of the EBSA is to assure the security of the retirement, health, and other workplace-related benefits of American workers such as yourself and their families. Mm-hmm. We accomplish this by developing what we hope are effective regulations, assisting and educating workers such as coming here tonight and providing as much information as we can. We do that with plan sponsors and fiduciaries and service providers, and of course, we vigorously enforce the law.
Mm-hmm. Now, okay, so kind of twofold there. You've got a protection and an education aspect.
We do, and I work in the Office of Education and Technical Assistance. Our office is composed of two primary responsibilities. One, of course, is our enforcement division. Their responsibility consists of investigators and auditors across the 10 different regional offices here in the United States. I happen to work in the Kansas City regional office. I am a benefits advisor, meaning I work in that Office of Outreach, Education, and Technical Assistance. We want you and we want to help educate you about what you need to know about preparing and understanding what your benefits are for retirement as well as in health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was particularly impressed with how much was there at your website and what a kind of thorough service you provide in terms of giving information that is critical in terms of planning for your retirement and kind of monitoring it along the way. You know, we all start pretty young at this in this workplace, and retirement seems like it's an awful long way away, but it's not really. And I think it's critically important that folks are aware of what's going on and kind of monitor their not just their retirement benefits, but their health care benefits as well as they change. So tell me, define fiduciary responsibility. That's a big word, and certainly it creates a lot of I don't knows in our workplace.
Well, fiduciary, at its basic definition, is a functional test under the regulations. Regardless of what their actual title is or what that person's responsibilities are, it's a test of whether they exercise discretion regarding the plan or their assets. So it's a very functional test. It's a case-by-case determination. The regulations specifically define certain positions to be a fiduciary, such as a plan administrator, or a trustee, or a plan sponsor, or investment managers. We have investment managers in today's realm of 401k plans. But those roles involve discretion and exercising that discretion over plan assets or administration. So there are other individuals that are hired that perform certain functions, but they may not always rise to the level of the current definition as a fiduciary. As you may or may not be aware, the department has proposed a new definition and functional test for fiduciary. That regulation and is scheduled to go into effect tomorrow.
Is that right? No, I was not aware of that. Could you explain a little bit of that for our listeners?
Well, I will tell you that I would direct you to the website for additional information. It's a very extensive regulation. I think it's important for people to read and then take some time to study that, and then they can gain a better understanding. In its most simplest of terms, it's holding people responsible that have your best interest at heart, and that's the basic definition of a fiduciary. We want the person controlling your money and helping you to control your money within the realm of these regulations to have your best interests beyond all others.
Certainly. You know, I was a part of a multi-employer pension plan, and of course, over the years, there were a lot of challenges in terms of how it was operated and how it was overseen. In effect, we had perhaps a government-appointed overseer, which was actually Eastern Jackson County judge back in the mid-'80s because of some challenges that my plan was having. And I can't call his name right off the top. But at any rate, he was the overseer for a good while. And sort of, even though we had trustees that was a part of that pension fund, he kind of oversaw their investments. I can't call his name. It's not important what is important is how it changed over the years and the fiduciary responsibility then under the consent agreement, which was a government agreement that oversaw the Teamsters Central States Pension Plan. And that, too, kind of changed the complexion of it. So over the years then, we had kind of a situation where everybody was pointing the finger of responsibility at everyone else, and it kind of made it confusing for all of us, particularly when ERISA law was changed and what had been benefits that were guaranteed kind of became subject to change. And so how did ERISA change the impact of the duties of your office?
Well, primarily what you're making reference to is the Multi-Employer Pension Reform Act, in which Congress proposed and passed legislation that, you are right, changes the face of how benefits are accrued and protected under those circumstances in which a plan becomes what we call critical and declining. Those particular plans are subject or potentially subject to a new sets of operations of how they handle their finances, and including basically, there is the ability for those plans to change accrued benefits that the individual pensioner has already earned. Department of Labor and EBSA has limited information and or oversight related to that. We primarily house and require the disclosure notices that participants are required to receive when a plan is in critical, endangered, or critical and declining status.
Okay, so essentially then, you kind of provide guidelines to educate employees how the the package may change.
And that's primarily what our responsibility is. Under ERISA, there are seven parts of ERISA that EBSA has oversight to. The first, and probably the most obvious that we do, are the reporting and disclosure requirements. And there's a good reason for that. Individual participants and beneficiaries of ERISA-covered plans, again, pension plans, 401k plans, you can't hold people accountable for understanding what their benefits are if you don't disclose to them how they earn them, how they access them, what their rights are. So we want to make sure that you as an individual participant in that plan receive needed information about what's going on with your pension plan so that you can exercise and make the right decisions about the most important thing you may do for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. So without getting that information, how can you plan appropriately? So that's part of what we do. You have, again, the big portion, the part four, which is the fiduciary rules. We set about some standards that fiduciaries have to follow. Mm-hmm. And then we have part six, which is about the continuation coverage, or COBRA, as it's more commonly known. We also have part seven. Part seven houses substantially almost all of the health benefit regulations that have been added to and amended ERISA over the years, such as the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, the Children's Health Insurance Information, the Genetic Information Non-Disclosure Act. So you've got a lot of information and some various regulations that have changed. And again, if you don't know what your group health plan pays or what you need to do to apply for your pension benefit, it would be very difficult for you to obtain that information and understand what you needed to do. So disclosure is a very important part of what we do. And I can tell you personally that I spend a lot of time in my office every day helping people obtain documents they need to be able to answer very critical questions about it, about understanding how their plan works.
So critical to the actual implementation of so many plans is the knowledge of how it's set up. And I know over the years, for instance, every year I received a statement from my pension provider giving me a ballpark picture of the plan, its investments, and how things were going there. So but I was really impressed, as I said already, about the services your organization provides related to that, because I'd call my pension there in Chicago and I'd basically get a runaround. But
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, you see, but looking at your website, well, certainly I would have been better educated had I went there first. And of course, mine was jointly administered. It was a as I said, a multi-employer pension plan who suffered the loss of a lot of employees over the course from the time I started way back in 1969 until now. Probably our numbers have diminished, oh my goodness, 90%. So it certainly created the situation that, caused the red zone kind of endangered species that we're looking at now, and the possibility of making some serious changes in how that goes. So, but at any rate, we're certainly happy to have you here, and we're certainly happy to know that this service is available for not just the union pensions, but all kind of encompass all pension plans.
Right. ERISA covers primarily private sector and union-sponsored plans. There are some exclusions. In particular, government plans are not protected by the regulations, and there are, and for the most part, church plans don't have that same level of protection. But absent that, there's a lot of plans out there. We're a small agency with a lot of responsibility and a big universe, and we have various ways that we try to reach you. We're glad that you and very pleased that you allowed us to come on today and share information. I want to make sure before we complete today that you know how to reach us. We have a toll-free number nationwide, works in the in all 50 states. That's 866-444-3272. You just allow the system to auto-select wherever you're at. It'll route that call to the closest EBSA office where you can talk to a benefit advisor, typically on a live basis in most situations. We staff 10 offices nationwide. I think there are two additional district offices that also have benefits advisors ready available to answer questions. We also, if you were on the website, you probably noticed we have a web intake form at askebsa.gov where you can actually submit your questions and information via web intake form. Typically, we get back to those within a day or two. We make a commitment to answer every call live that we can. In the event that you may need to leave a message, we return those calls by the next business day. So we have active benefits advisors waiting to answer questions or register complaints, because sometimes that's what it is. It's a registering of a complaint. But in Kansas City, we have 10 benefits advisors. Mm-hmm. So hopefully there's somebody available that you can speak to and talk about your issues or get answers to your questions. We're here to help. That's what we want to do.
Okie doke. Well, certainly it's an invaluable service, and we're so happy that it's available. And as I said, I wish that I was a bit more knowledgeable about the service that you provide before my retirement. I've been out about 5 years now, and certainly I kind of went into retirement with a lot of uncertainty. So certainly I would encourage our listeners to take advantage of the service provided at EBSA, and look forward to that day when everyone decides they can't do this anymore and it's time to get out of here. So
I'm approaching that age myself, Michael. I look at my retirement funds and I watch them carefully, and I want to make sure that people understand that they should be, if particularly in today's arena of 401k plans. Most of us no longer have defined benefit plans, even those, and those are struggling, just as yours. You made mention that your pension plan is struggling. For a large percentage of us, we have 401k plans. Mm-hmm. You should, for the most part, be getting quarterly statements. Mm-hmm. If you're not, it's time to start asking questions about that.
Absolutely. Well, we had, in my particular situation, we had a defined benefit and a 401k investment. So I do watch that carefully, and I'm not eligible until 72 and a half, I think, to start drawing down the 401k benefits. But certainly with the challenges the pension plan is having, why that 401k backup is certainly one that I'm glad is there. So, but at any rate, Fran, we want to thank you for being a part of the Heartland Labor Forum tonight. And
you got 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Okay. And certainly, let me ask about the responsibility, the fiduciary responsibility. I know in my situation, when we had, of course, the trustees involved who actually didn't, while it was their job to oversee the investments, that didn't necessarily work that way. And I think the consent agreement had something to do with how that was done. Now, who was actually responsible then becomes a situation where this guy's pointing at that one, and you may not know the answer to that question.
Well, you're talking about a lot of history from a long time ago, but I am familiar with the consent decree, and I am familiar with how that situation arose with Central States. But it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the plan has taken remedial action and is attempting remedial action, and again, I think we'll have to wait for the next proposed involving what they're going to do with that in general. But fiduciaries have a responsibility to act solely in the interest of the participants and beneficiaries of the plan, and they need to do so with due diligence and prudence, and they have to monitor their service providers. So there's a fiduciary carries a lot of responsibility about how the plan functions and operates, and ultimately carries an individual responsibility as well.
Mm-hmm.
So prudence, diligence, monitoring, very key to a fiduciary's responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. Well, with that, well, we want to certainly thank you, Fran, for showing up and sharing with our listeners those aspects that I think are so important in planning a successful retirement.
Thank you for allowing us to come on, both you, Michael, Judy. Thank you very much.
Very good.
Hi, this is Judy again, and we want to announce first off that we made our match, and in fact, we went way beyond it, and so we want to thank, oh boy, Dennis in Overland Park. We want to thank Gail and congratulate Gail on winning an award tonight, I believe, and Chris and Molly and Hester, and we're doing great, but we need to support KKFI with more pledges because our radio station is pretty expensive to run. Just think about the electric bill for a 100,000-watt tower. And you know that these pledge drives are absolutely essential to keep KKFI on the air. So we have some other premiums to offer you if you call 888-931-0901. Three books that we have either reviewed on KKFI or are going to review. The first is The Mythology of Work, How Capitalism Persists Despite Itself by Peter Fleming. This is one we reviewed a couple of months ago. And you can get it for a pledge of $50 to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. And then two upcoming books. The first is called The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time, by Gordon Lafer. Gordon is a labor educator and researcher, and he has done tremendous work on right to work and other kinds of initiatives at the state level. And you can find out the sad news from this book of how our states are changing by calling 888-931-0901. And finally, the third book is called Big Hunger, which I think we're doing next week or the week after, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. Actually, we did this last week, I just recalled, by Andrew Fisher. And this is about how food banks and their corporate partners are discouraged from talking about the root causes of hunger and poverty in America. And it's a real good investigative report on what's going on behind the scenes. So call us at 888-931-0901 to make a pledge. And if you'd like a book, make a pledge of $50. If you'd like a T-shirt, make a pledge of $90. You can also pledge online at kkfi.org. And now, Jen, back to the show.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, and I saw above me that endless skyway, I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled and I followed my footsteps in the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me, a voice was a-sounding. This land was made for you and me. There was a big high wall there that tried to stop me. A sign was painted, said private property. But on the backside, it didn't say nothing. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust cloud rolling. My voice was chanting as the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
I'm Lon. Tonight on Heartland Labor Forum, we will be talking with Greg Bertan. Greg is a disability activist and scholar. He has a PhD in education from the Institute of Education, University College London. He is currently based in New York State, working for the Center for Disability Rights. He is a member of ADAPT and the co-founder of CRIP the Vote. Craig, would you tell us, tell our listeners a little bit about the CRIP the Vote?
Sure. CRIP the Vote was a project we started during last year's election to bring disability issues into the election. Many of us were in the disability community, were watching the election unfold and seeing no one talking about our issues. Even when they were talking about issues that were relevant to the community, they tended to ignore our community's existence. And so myself, Alice Wong, and Andrew Pulrang were all on Twitter talking about, you know, this silence on our issues. And so, you know, we thought about what we could do, and we decided a hashtag campaign was the way to go. So we started out with some chats, mostly around the debates.
Right.
And then that expanded to the point where we've now had, I think, 24 chats, I believe. I could be wrong. On a variety of issues, from the violence experienced by disabled people, the disabled people's experience of our criminal system,
it's a variety of things that are being done by that particular hashtag. Now, then, before
right, I mean, it started out as us, you know, leading right. chats, but what was kind of amazing about it was that the community sort of took over the hashtag.
Okay.
To the point where people are tweeting on it, you know, 24 hours a day. And so it wasn't just the events we scheduled, but people using it as a community to, you know, express our concerns. There are people that were tweeting at politicians with their issues, and people that were, sharing articles that were written about disability issues.
Right.
And so it really took on a life of its own over the course of, you know, the last year and a half.
Okay. Now, then, before we get into the action in Washington, D.C. on May 15th, 16th, and 17th, tell us what ADAPT is.
Okay, ADAPT is a grassroots disability rights organization. It started out in there's some debate about this. I mean, it really started in 1978 with some actions in Denver, but it formally became ADAPT in, I guess, 1983, and it started out working on public transportation access, but quickly, you know, through the success of direct actions,
right,
expanded to look at all disability rights issues. ADAPT was the driving force behind the passage of the ADA. There was an event we led called that's known as the Capitol Crawl, in which disabled activists, I mean, literally, you know, hundreds of disabled activists crawled up the Capitol steps to highlight, you know, the significance of inaccessibility in this country. And it's largely credited as one of the moments that pushed the ADA into passage. Nowadays, we've been concentrating most of our efforts on fighting for disabled people's rights to live in the community.
Right.
That would be pretty good. The passage of Olmstead.
Right. Now, we'll go with what happened. So would you tell us what ADAPT did on May 15th and why?
Sure. On May 15th, about a little over 200 ADAPT members went to the White House. Sorry, what's that?
White House? What's going on?
I'm getting echo, sorry.
All right.
About 200 members of ADAPT went to the White House, and we brought with us several demands for the White House to address. And first among them was to get the Trump administration into supporting the Disability Integration Act. And there were others as well I can, you know, share if you'd like. But the main focus was to bring the administration into line in supporting the Disability Integration Act. So far, they've been relatively silent.
Greg, would you tell us what ADAPT did on May 15th and why?
Sure. On May 15th, I'd say a little over 200 ADAPTers went to the White House to try and get the Trump administration to publicly acknowledge that Americans with disabilities are being denied their constitutional rights to life, liberty, and due process when they're being denied long-term medical care and services and supports that force them into nursing facilities and other institutions. We wanted to get, in light of this, we wanted to, demand that the administration endorse and push the passage of the Disability Integration Act, which is bipartisan legislation that's aimed at strengthening the ADA's integration mandate.
Right.
The DIA is a piece of legislation we helped craft with both Senator Chuck Schumer and Representative Jim Sensenbrenner to say that insurers, whether they're Medicaid or private insurers, if they offer long-term supports and services, they have to offer them to people in the community. And so this has been largely the recent emphasis of ADAPT. And so we went to the White House and we made these demands and chained ourselves to the barricades until they, were either met or we were arrested. And we were largely ignored by the White House, but we were arrested and people paid attention to that. And, ADAPT is working hard to put these issues on people's agenda. They're trying to, make people take notice. And, whether or not the administration took notice, we heard later in the week from politicians that we met with to discuss the DIA that they had taken notice.
Right. The story was that I heard that there was a Colorado senator or representative that gotten back with ADAPTers themselves to talk about it. So it so did have some influence.
There's footage out there, if you can find it, of a longtime adapter, Dawn Russell, confronting her politician, I mean, some of her representatives, and trying to get, working to get them on to DIA. And, right. and some of them come on because of, you know, the action that we took
right.
at the White House.
Now, on May 16th, we did a lot of traveling. Could you explain mm-hmm. that and where we wound up and why we were
sure.
there and what was the major thrust of what we were doing?
Right. On May 16th, we went to the FDA, and I should actually give you a little background into that. ADAPT had an action in the fall in Boston, and then when we were there, we went to a place in Canton, Massachusetts, called the Judge Rotenberg Center. This is a horrible institution that has been cited by the UN Rapporteur on Torture as a site of torture. They use electroshock aversives as punishment for any behaviors they deem inappropriate. So often things that disabled people find comforting, you know, things that we call self, you know, stims, which is just a way of soothing yourself. These are met with punishments of being shocked by electronic devices that they strap to people. And so, you know, the UN has called this torture. And so we went there and we occupied their entrance last fall. And this trip on the 16th was actually a follow-up to that. We went to the FDA because the FDA has a proposed rule that would ban the devices that this center uses to torture disabled people. But it should have been finalized last spring, and they've, you know, a year ago last spring, and they've sat on it for over a year now.
Right.
And done nothing. So ADAPT went as a follow-up to try and push the FDA into action. And unfortunately, you know, while they admitted horror at the idea of strapping anyone to these devices, they would not move on this rule for reasons they would not explain to us.
So what we're doing is basically asking them to finish up the bill so that none of this would happen throughout the United States.
Right. It's not even a bill. It's an administrative rule that would say these devices cannot be used.
Okay.
It doesn't need to pass through Congress. It doesn't need any legislation. If the FDA can take care of this, you know, with the signature of their administrator. It's not something that that really requires a lot of them. They've consulted. They've received testimony from every major disability rights organization in the country, from educational groups that oppose this. This, you would think, would be a simple thing. Don't torture disabled kids. But unfortunately, the FDA has failed to act on this.
Okay.
So 84 ADAPT members were arrested outside the FDA on the 16th of May, you know, in protest of their inaction.
Right. Now, on May 17th, we did something different. We went to the Capitol to talk to senators about the Disability Integration Act and to explain why Medicaid, the way it is set up now, needs to stay the same way, the same for that. So can you describe a little bit of what Medicaid does for people?
Well, I mean, yeah, before I go on, I mean, I would say
The 17th was more celebratory for us. We were celebrating the fact that Representative Sensenbrenner had just introduced the Disability Integration Act into the House of Representatives. The fact that, we now had a bipartisan introduction, a Democrat on one side, Republican on the other. This is, something that parties could actually come together on. So we did go. We went to visit many senators and representatives,
right,
and talk about why DIA was so important. And, many, it was also a chance to talk about why it was so important that we...
So we need... I appreciate this.
State Medicaid.
We need to wrap this up, and I really appreciate it. It's just a bigger topic than I thought it would be. And so, Greg, thank you very much for the interview, and I appreciate it. And I'm Lon Swarnia.
Anytime. If you guys get more time, happy to talk about this some more. I'd love to tell you about
I'm sure you will. Thank you. I'll get back with you later sometime.
Take care.
Thank you.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Good evening and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel. Juneteenth is the oldest known celebration commemorating the ending of slavery in the United States. The date was chosen to commemorate the late abolition of slaves in Texas. On June 19, 1865, Union soldiers led by Major General Gordon Granger landed at Galveston, Texas with news that the war had ended and that the enslaved were now free. Note that this was 2.5 years after President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which had become official January 1, 1863. The Emancipation Proclamation had little impact on the Texans due to the minimal number of Union troops to enforce the new executive order. However, with the surrender of General Lee in April of 1865 and the arrival of General Granger's regiment, the forces were finally strong enough to influence and overcome the resistance. Later attempts to explain this 2.5 year delay in the receipt of this important news has led to some diverse theories over the years. Often told is the story of a messenger who was murdered on his way to Texas with the news of freedom. Another is that the news was deliberately withheld by the enslavers to maintain the labor force on the plantations. And still another is that federal troops actually waited for the slave owners to reap the benefits of one last cotton harvest before going to Texas to enforce the Emancipation Proclamation. Whatever the reasons, conditions in Texas remained status quo well beyond what was statutory. One of General Granger's first orders of business was to read to the people of Texas General Order No. 3, which began most significantly with, "The people of Texas are informed that in accordance with a proclamation from the Executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and free laborer." The reactions to this profound news ranged from pure shock to immediate jubilation. While many lingered to learn of this new employer-to-employee relationship, many more left before these offers were completely off the lips of their former masters, attesting to the varying conditions on the plantations and the realization of freedom. Even with nowhere to go, many felt that leaving the plantation would be their first grasp of freedom. North was a logical destination, and for many it represented true freedom, while the desire to reach family members in neighboring states drove others into Louisiana, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. Settling into these new areas as free men and women brought on new realities, and the challenges of establishing a heretofore non-existent status for black people in America. The annual recounting of the memories of that great day in June of 1865 and its festivities would serve as motivation as well as a release from the growing pressures encountered in their new territory. The celebration of June 19th was coined Juneteenth and grew with more participation from descendants. The Juneteenth celebration was a time for reassuring each other, for praying, and for gathering remaining family members. Juneteenth continued to be highly revered in Texas decades later, with many former slaves and descendants making an annual pilgrimage back to Galveston on this date. Today, Juneteenth is enjoying a phenomenal growth rate within communities and organizations throughout the country. Institutions such as the Smithsonian, the Henry Ford Museum, and others have begun sponsoring Juneteenth-centered activities. In recent years, a number of local and national Juneteenth organizations have arisen to take their place alongside older organizations, all with the mission to promote and cultivate knowledge and appreciation of African American history and culture. Juneteenth today celebrates African American freedom and achievement while encouraging continuous self-development and respect for all cultures. It takes on a more national, symbolic, and even global perspective. The events of 1865 in Texas are not forgotten, for all of the roots tie back to this fertile soil from which a national day of pride is growing. Adapted from Juneteenth.com. Have a good evening, fellow workers.
And that was, of course, our own Arianna Eckel with Remember Our Struggle. And with me, I'm Judy Ansel, and with me in the studio is Bill Claus, one of the founders of the Heartland Labor Forum.
Oh, my goodness.
29 years ago. Yeah, you don't look the same, Bill.
I don't feel the same either, but, you know,
But you're still here at KKFI.
I am still here at KKFI.
And why is that? Why should the listeners out there be pledging to us?
Because I think that, you know, people have to realize what an important service it is to bring to the local community all the things that KKFI brings as far as labor news, as far as understanding what's going on in the community is concerned, as far as culture you don't hear anywhere else, as far as, we were one of the first people to bring Amy Goodman to Kansas City.
That's right.
As far as that's concerned.
Right.
And on and on and on. And so, you know, call us up now and show your support for KKFI, for public affairs that is locally produced, but is nationally produced as far as all the things that are important in the world is concerned.
And that number to call is 888-931-0901. And while we've made our goal and then some tonight, we still have some premiums to offer you.
We do, and I'm going to add one that hasn't been talked about tonight.
Oh, right, I forgot about that one.
You did forget about that one, but I'm going to bring it up, and that is on August the 21st, there's going to be something that happened once in your lifetime, and that is a total eclipse of the sun. Now, if you're south of the Missouri River, you're going to have to drive a few minutes north of the Missouri River on August the 21st to get the total effect of the total eclipse of the sun. But you can do that, and we will also, anybody that calls in between now and the end of this program, I am going to send you some glasses that you can watch the total eclipse by without hurting your eyes.
This is not a scam?
It's not a scam. I've got 200 of them.
If I put on these glasses, can I see the total eclipse before August 21st?
You can't. Well, you can see it during the eclipse.
Okay.
If you put the glasses on at night, it'd be like the total eclipse before then, except you won't see the ball in the sky.
Okay. 888-931-0901. Get your own original Watch the Eclipse glasses for any pledge, no matter how small.
That's right. And I want to encourage people to stay tuned after KKF, after Heartland Labor Forum, because Heartland Labor Forum is definitely one of my favorite programs on KKFI. It's really a program that is just chock full of things that you need to know about what's going on in our community. But the show that we're doing at 7 o'clock tonight is a show unlike we've ever done at KKFI. It's called the River City Chautauqua. And the Chautauqua is an event that happened during the late 19th and early 20th century where people came together for several days and they talked about such things as history, they talked about such things as science, they talked about philosophy, they talked about culture, and all those things are jam-packed in the one-hour show that we're doing right after Heartland Labor Forum. And you can and I would like you to call in during that show as well and show your support both for Heartland Labor Forum and for the Chautauqua, River City Chautauqua at 7 o'clock.
So, fellow workers, as Arianna would say, that's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. We're going to be discussing Detroit. Are the engines restarting? Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman. You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events,
call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI.